This is Car Expert.
You can just tell that Toyota has given us everything. I have massive hopes for what this car is going to deliver, and I'm not the only one.
They have jurors from all over the world, and they vote on cars in five different categories. One is the World Car of the Year.
With the Cerato GT, you get a very, very well-composed car.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. G'day to Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy.
And James Wong, hello.
Hi, everyone.
We're just coming out of lockdown in Victoria, yay, which means you guys have been driving the same cars for the last couple of weeks during lockdown. Marco, you've been driving the Kona EV. What's your time behind the wheel been like?
Oh, the horror of having to drive the same car for 2 weeks for the first time in decades. No, look, it's been great. Obviously, I haven't been doing a heap of driving. I had a fun experience today, though. There's a big EV hub, a ChargeFox EV hub, within the bubble distance of my house. So I drove my little empty Kona electric up to a 350 kilowatt tritium, Brisbane-made tritium DC charger, and started, you know, using my app, which ChargeFox have got a great app to charge up my car. And I'm thinking, you know, here I am, cutting edge, you know, this is great. And then this bloke pulls up in a brand new Porsche Taycan Turbo, which I think is the definition of being completely alphaed, because, you know, the Kona Electric's a cute little EV, isn't it? But the Taycan Turbo just completely trumps it. But it did make me sort of think about, people talk about, you know, how hard it must be to live with an EV. But I just want to tell you my quick story, which is within the 5Ks of my house, there is one of these super powerful DC chargers. I have a subscription to ChargeFox, the app provider. I plug the CCS DC Type 2 connector into my EV, and in 30 minutes, I put in about 30 kilowatt hours worth of power at a maximum rate drawdown of 77 kilowatts. Now, what that means is I added about 220 Ks of range in 30 minutes, or about half the charge of the battery in 30 minutes. And in that 30 minutes, I went in to the bakery, got myself a croissant, continued this massive weight gain that I've been embarking on lately in lockdown, had a coffee, had a quick five-minute chin wag to old mate in the Taycan, and then hit the road again. And in that time, I went from having 10 Ks of range to having more than 200 Ks of range. Now, I know it's not for everybody, but I don't think that is that big of an impost or that big of a problem, spending 30 minutes charging a car. And it really kind of, I think, it's an experience like that that really maybe is the key to changing people's minds around how easy or not it is to live with an EV.
Especially if you're at like a shopping centre, like a grocery store, if you're doing a big shop, it can take half an hour to do something like that. And yeah, to be able to come back to the car and know that you've just gained a couple of hundred Ks while you were shopping instead of standing at a petrol bowser filling it up for a couple of minutes.
And you don't need to charge it all the way up. You don't need to go from 10% to 100% and leave it overnight. You can zap it up and sort of charge as you go and just play around in that mid-level charge cycle and just keep the car running if you need to. So obviously charging overnight in your wall box is what you really want to be doing. But I just thought it was a nice kind of aside just to kind of give people an insight into what EV ownership is actually like.
Absolutely.
For sure. I think that's a really interesting insight and perspective because, you know, for me, I'm somebody that's sort of in the range anxiety mindset because I do the occasional long trip and like to know that I don't have to think about it. Whereas when you have a 10K bubble or whatever, there's been a few times where I've just wanted to duck down somewhere in the cold or because it's raining and I don't want to walk down there. And I'm like, far out. It would have been nice to have something that's like a plug-in hybrid or an EV so I don't feel like I have to be rude to the engine by starting it up and turning it off again in 2 minutes or whatever. So it's, yeah, that kind of stuff is an interesting perspective for sure.
It's been a bit of a big week for car reveals this week, JY. We've seen the 2022 Kia Sportage revealed and it's coming here later in the year.
Yes, so Kia has revealed the fifth generation of its popular Sportage midsize SUV. My family actually has a previous, not the previous generation, but the one before that. So we're, you know, big Kia people in my family. So I was quite excited to see what this looked like. And then I saw the face and I was like, it's a bit, it's quite an eccentric design. The front is very like space age alien helmet sort of thing. But what this car is for Kia is very similar to what the Tucson means for Hyundai and they're the same car underneath. So, you know, very important vehicles, the pretty much the biggest segment in Australia and one of the most competitive segments worldwide. So they want to stand out, and with this design, they're certainly going to stand out, and it's going to grow in size. They didn't actually detail the engines that are coming to Australia or that will be available globally in any of their press releases, which was a bit odd. But if we use the Tucson as an example or as a guide, we kind of can gather what will be coming here. So the Tucson just launched in Australia with the 2-litre petrol front-wheel drive. It's a naturally aspirated one. It's the base engine. That should be the engine that's fitted to lower grades. And then 1.6-litre turbo and 2-litre turbo diesel engines should be offered with all-wheel drive. And then what we're hoping for, but we're not sure yet, is whether they'll offer the hybrid and plug-in hybrid versions like they do in the Tucson. So while they actually didn't confirm electrification just yet, it's almost certain. The Sportage, sorry, I'm almost getting them confused. The Sportage is going to grow as well. So globally for basically everywhere but Europe, there's going to be a long wheelbase version like the Tucson. So it'll grow to about the same size as the Tucson, RAV4, that sort of thing, but still slightly smaller than something like a Mitsubishi Outlander and X-Trail that offer 7 seats. And it will be a tech masterpiece by the looks of it. We can see one shot of the front cockpit, and it's got like this really cool curved display and these new touch controls that are very much in line with what Kia is producing at the moment with the new EV6, which is going to be their basically hero car, which is their new dedicated electric vehicle that's very techy, very touchscreeny, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, this will be a really big deal for them, and we'll get more information about it in the coming weeks and months, because the Korean launch I think will be within a matter of months. Europe will get it soon. So, and obviously here it's one of their top sellers too. So very important car for Kia.
Yeah, I had a really interesting chat with a mate of mine at Kia this week who works in their product planning team, and he was talking about the opportunities this car has that the old one didn't, because, you know, we know the Toyota RAV4 dominates sales now, and it's a bit bigger than the old Sportage was. The new one, as you said, Wongy, is around the same size. It's much more differentiated from the Seltos, and the company found, and you know, this guy admitted that the Seltos was actually stealing sales off of Sportage in a pretty big way. And so this is going to really sort of space out the range of SUVs that Kia has to offer much better. We also know that about 60% of RAV4s being sold now are hybrids, and there's about a 6-month wait list because, you know, the fairly underwhelming Subaru Forester aside, there is no other mild hybrid mid-sized SUV in that price band kicking around. So while it's not confirmed that Kia will be able to source the hybrid in right-hand drive from the Korean plant for Australia, it's working super hard to make that happen. I would say that it's a better than even chance that it will happen. And if it happens, it'll give Toyota some much-needed competition in that sort of fuel-sipping end of the mid-sized SUV market as well.
For sure.
What price do we reckon this might launch at?
Well, the current one retails for between 30 and 50 grand, depending on the model that you get, powertrain, all that kind of stuff, which is basically what the Tucson did as well. With the new one, it really depends on how they spec it. So that if they do, you know, all the safety kit as standard across the range with, you know, good headlights and the big infotainment system for most models, you might see that base price creep up to between 32 and 35 plus on-road costs with a sharp drive-away deal, which Kia tends to do. They tend to undercut a little bit with the drive-away pricing. And then you might see it climb to between 50 and 55, you know, for a high-spec diesel all-wheel drive model. So similar ballpark, maybe just a little bit higher.
And, you know, every year it seems like a different vehicle segment is just completely up for wholesale change. And this year it's definitely the mid-sized SUV market. We've seen the updated Volkswagen Tiguan launch, the brand new Hyundai Tucson just arrived. We've got the Sportage around the corner. Brand new Mitsubishi Outlander is only a few months away now. Brand new Nissan X-Trail, ground up redesign early in next year. Help me out here, Wongy. I don't know. I'm sure I'm forgetting one or two options, but it does stand like that massive segment of the market, which sometimes makes up to 20% of all cars sold, is up for a wholesale sort of refresh this year. And as sort of to touch on the same point, with the RAV4 being so dominant for so long, I think we're going to see a little bit of a change in the dynamics of that market in the next few months, with some of these new players really starting to eat into the RAV4's market share.
Yeah, for sure. I think what we're seeing is that people are willing to pay for good or good value or just, you know, competent product. And, you know, Toyota's, the bulk of Toyota RAV4 wait times are for the Cruiser Hybrid, which is like a $45,000 car plus on roads. So if that's the average transaction price, I don't think a $40,000 to $50,000 Kia is going to be a problem, especially when you see, you know, for example, Sorento and Santa Fe now nudging the $70,000 mark and people are buying those. I think now that we're seeing that across the industry where cars are just more expensive in general, because once you start adding features and safety kit and all that kind of stuff, it bumps up the price. And, you know, it's not, I think now the Australian consumer, even though they want stuff to be affordable and, you know, the market's very competitive, I think as long as the value equation is still there, people are willing to pay for it. So I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, certainly. We're going to stick with another reveal of an SUV this week. We've seen quite a few spy and leaked photos of the Toyota Land Cruiser 300 series, but now it's been officially unveiled, Moko.
Yeah, just about the biggest reveal of the year, really. The new Land Cruiser doesn't come along all that often. This is the first new one in 14 years. The 200 series premiered back in 2007. And its sales have only increased over the past year or so as people have sought the ultimate off-roader to tow that caravan into the sticks now that they can't go overseas with flight bans and things of that nature. We've been seeing 200 series Cruiser V8s going for nearly $200,000 on the classifieds in the past few months. So this has been one of the most hotly awaited cars for a while. The company revealed it overnight with some of the worst press shots I've ever seen in my life, not doing the car the kind of justice they should be. But despite that, it manages to look excellent. Now, this isn't some mild refresh. After 14 years, you'd bloody well hope that the 300 series Land Cruiser would be an entirely new from the ground up car. And it is. So it's the first body on frame iteration of Toyota's global TNGA architecture. So it's stiffer with a lower center of gravity than before. It's about 200 kilograms lighter than the old one, has revised suspension geometry, a new electrically actuated anti-roll bar disconnect system. So that improves your axle articulation. Basically, it's dimensionally no different to the car that came before it, the 200 series, but essentially every single nut and bolt in this car has been replaced. The old 4.5-litre V8 diesel goes bye-bye and is replaced by a 3.3-litre twin-turbo V6 diesel, which has more power and torque than the outgoing car, mated to a 10-speed automatic. So when you put all those things together, this new one's going to be a heck of a lot more fuel-efficient than the pretty thirsty old V8. The company has said it has gone out of its way to make this the most comfortable on-road car that it possibly can. It has placed a really big emphasis on improving NVH suppression and ride comfort. So grey nomads and the like are going to be really blown away by this. Evolutionary on the outside, but inside it's a wholesale rejig. You know, it's got some incredible tech inside, massive horizontally arrayed center touchscreen with a really cool off-road multi-view camera that looks pretty much true to life. You know, compared to the fairly dated old car inside, it's a revolution. Really interestingly, there was also a line in there that really grabbed me from the chief engineer. Toyota makes these fantastic videos to accompany any reveal like this where they talk to a lot of usually Japanese engineers that have been working on the car. And the chief engineer, he talked about spending a lot of time driving around Australia. He did an entire lap of Australia in the 200 series talking to people out in the bush, because Australia is about 10% of Land Cruiser sales worldwide and possibly the most important market for the car, certainly one of the most important markets for the car. So Australia has a really big seat at the table. And he just talked about how he saw Australia as being perhaps the key development market for the vehicle. And for those real, you know, 4x4 fans out there, he quite interestingly touched on the 80 series Land Cruiser from 1989, which finished up in 1998, as the yardstick for 4x4 performance. So he said the new 300 is going to be the best, you know, on-road, high-tech, luxurious 300 Land Cruiser that we've ever seen. But he also said specifically that the 80 series, in his opinion, was the best off-road Land Cruiser ever made, and the goal was for the 300 to beat that. So he's ignored the last two generations and gone right back to the early 90s. And I know a lot of hardcore 4x4 guys will be delighted to hear that, because the 80 series remains an icon to this day alongside the GQ Patrol. So it really does feel like Toyota has balanced the old and the new, the strengths with some modern tech. We know in the future a hybrid drivetrain will come in a couple of years' time, but we don't know a heck of a lot about that, so it's diesel only for Australia at this stage. And perhaps the most important thing, it'll arrive in Australia towards the end of this year. The company has promised that stocks will hit before the end of 2021. And when you consider the markups that have been happening on the 200 series Sahara, who the hell knows what the pricing is going to be? We could have this crazy scenario where the new twin turbo 6 cruiser is actually cheaper than run out V8 models. Who the hell knows why, but that just seems to be the way the market's going. So massive, massive reveal. And we've got some great content up on the site. So if you're interested, go and check it out.
Yeah, you stole my thunder there, Moko, because I wanted to talk about that video that you just mentioned. I spent about 10, 15 minutes watching that today, and I just found it fascinating. I'm not really a Land Cruiser guy, but I always thought that, you know, in my relatively short career so far, that, you know, the Japanese brands and the executives that work there typically aren't super open with things like, you know, what the criticisms are of their product and all that kind of stuff. And the way that they really went into, you know, what they didn't like about the 200 series, he talked about his lap around Australia, what they did to improve it, the golden ratio of the wheelbase that's been in place since the 80 series. Like, it was so interesting, and to see how the car has evolved fairly, you know, it's been quite incremental in how it's evolved, but in those evolutions, there's been revolutions. And I think that's what's so cool about this car. It's so old school, but it's now been blended in with all this modern stuff to become, you know, the ultimate cross-country vehicle, or what, you know, and it's such a big thing for that brand. So it's so much cool content on the site. Please watch that video if you get the chance, because it's so, so interesting.
And just to touch on that, we think that car engineers today are only motivated by semiconductors and touchscreens and active safety technologies. But TMC's chief expert of off-road drivability, Kazuyuki Ueno, had a really cool quote, I thought, where he went really granular. You know, sometimes they say things like, we made small improvements, but you just want to say, what? What did you improve? Well, Ueno-san gave a great example, which was, quote, the rear shock absorbers on the 200 series had a sharp camber angle for the tires. The tires were not aligned with the stroke direction, making the car less steady. So we adjusted the frame on the new model to position the shock absorbers perfectly. That's a pretty boring quote in isolation, but when you consider that not only are they talking about what the new car has, but how it has specifically addressed weaknesses with the old one, you can just tell that Toyota has given us everything. And, you know, I have massive hopes for what this car is going to deliver. And I'm not the only one.
Moving on to the next story. This seems like a never-ending story, actually. Chevrolet Corvette finally orders are open.
I know. It feels like we've been talking about this for a really, really long time. Yeah. So General Motors Special Vehicles, or GMSV, which essentially replaces HSV, I guess, have announced that the orders for the all-new Chevrolet Corvette are open, and they've also priced a new carbon edition, which apparently is exclusive to Australia and New Zealand. So in case you needed a refresher, the new Corvette is the first mid rear engine one. I can't remember whether they say it's mid or rear engine, but it's a 6.2 litre V8 in the back with 364 kilowatts and 630 newton metres. And it is bloody quick, according to the official figures. So it will do 0 to 100 in just 2.9 seconds, which is madness. It's almost as quick as some hypercars. So it's going to be landing here towards the end of this year. And so they've third quarter of 2021. So the range will kick off with the entry level, and I use the term entry level very loosely, with the Corvette 2LT, which will be available from $144,990 plus on-road costs. You'll also be able to get that as a convertible for an extra $15,000. And then you can also get the 3LT for $160,500 with the convertible version, adding another $15,000 on that. So the standard equipment at the base level includes stuff like a head-up display, a bimodal exhaust, adaptive magnetic ride control dampers, Brembo brakes, limited slip diff, etc., etc. And then if you are able to step up to the carbon edition, which will be a whole $189,990, and I believe that's only available as a coupe, that'll get you stuff like carbon fiber exterior elements, as well as in the interior, so dash and door panels, color-coded brake calipers, a carbon fiber roof, and an engine appearance lighting package. It's almost like a display cabinet at the back. So this thing is basically an exotic supercar for, you know, maybe entry-level Porsche money. You can get all of these models for the price of a, you know, less than the price of a base 911, and it's going to be factory right-hand drive. So this announcement actually coincided very shortly after with the launch of the right-hand drive Corvette in Japan. So the photos that we've used in the story are from that event. And it's so funny because the Mount Fuji Raceway is so beautiful and picturesque that I initially thought that these photos were taken out of Gran Turismo. because they've got all the different colors. It's so vibrant. It's so beautiful. And it just doesn't look real almost. There's one shot of from the rear of the Corvette, and it's got like Mount Fuji in the background. Absolutely breathtaking. So this car is such a big deal because I think Holden for a long time promised a V8 rear wheel drive sports car or sports sedan following the death of the Commodore and blah, 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 blah. That's what, last decade now. So for this to really come through, I reckon this could prove to be a really popular car, especially as people are sort of forced to buy things like AMG products at the moment because they can't really get a really cool V8 rear wheel drive car anymore. And the next C class is going to move to four cylinder only. So this could be a dinosaur or a unicorn, however you want to look at it within, you know, this premium performance space. It's just so interesting. Really excited to see it come here.
Really glad you just touched on Holden, Wongy. Obviously, General Motors Special Vehicles is behind this one. There's a lot of bad blood in Australia around General Motors, rightly or wrongly. You know, there is some truth to the bad blood, and there are some misunderstandings around it as well. But I'm going to be really curious to see how performance enthusiasts receive the Corvette, not because of the quality of the vehicle, but because of that, you know, image hit that GM has taken. That's despite the fact that the global design chief of GM is an Aussie, Mike Simcoe, who used to run Holden Design and who was responsible for this car. So there is a big Aussie connection to it. But what's your feel? Do you reckon people are going to wrap their arms around this, or they're going to say, get stuffed, GM? You know, you dudded us once. We don't want to talk to you anymore. What do you reckon?
Well, if you use Ford as an example, everyone has a bloody Mustang, and that was after the Falcon died. So unless they did something different and pissed more people off, I reckon this is just going to sell like hotcakes. It's priced the same as a C63 coupe and is a whole second quicker to 100. And it looks awesome, and it's a Chevrolet Corvette. Some people might not even realize the Holden connection. So I reckon this could be a real opportunity for them, and I reckon we're going to see a lot of these on not just Victorian roads, on Australian roads.
Yeah, it certainly looks way more expensive than it actually is priced, so it's only a good
thing. For sure.
Okay. And lastly, Moco, we have seen official photos of the 2022 Ford Maverick, but surprise, surprise, another Ford product not coming here.
Yes, Scott Collier, colleague, wrote a great op-ed talking about all the cool Fords that we don't get in Australia, the Bronco Sport, the Mustang Mach E, the Puma ST. I'm sure I'm forgetting one or two, but
the list goes on.
The F-150 Lightning electric truck, you name it. Ford, you know, I don't know what Australia did to annoy Ford, but anyway, another reveal in America this week, another American-only product called the Ford Maverick. Now, for motoring aficionados may remember, the Ford Maverick was actually a rebadged GQ Nissan Patrol that was sold for about 2 minutes in the early 90s, and there's still a few kicking around. This is not one of those. This is actually a light-duty pickup truck. It's a monocoque construction, so it's quite similar to the Bronco Sport, and the Escape underneath comes standard with a hybrid drivetrain, although it does also come with a 2-litre turbo and all-wheel drive if you want a bit more poke. And basically it's designed to be a little pickup truck with car-like capabilities, car-like comfort, car-like interior, slightly less massive than a Ranger, but still with the ability to tow stuff and carry stuff in the back. You know, not everybody in the world who has a pickup truck really needs the massive workhorse. It's just that sometimes I don't have the alternative. There's clearly a growing interest in this. Hyundai just launched a car called Santa Cruz in the United States, which is conceptually very similar to a vehicle of this type. Kind of makes the Commodore and Falcon Utes from the Australian market of all those decades seem a little bit ahead of their time when you think about it. But I actually quite like this thing. It looks the part. I think they're gonna get a lot of people who maybe were buying compact SUVs who want something a bit more adventurous, who actually opt for a Maverick and sort of democratize the pickup truck. What do you reckon, Wongy?
I find the controversy or the hysteria around it not coming here quite odd because, I don't know, Australia is just one of those weird markets where, you know, you look at how popular the Ranger and the Hilux have gotten. And I just feel that, you know, depending on how they would price it here, you know, it starts in the low to mid 20s in the US. But then, you know, if you were to factor in the engineering for right-hand drive, importing it here, all that kind of stuff, I can't imagine it starting for less than 30. So you're looking at 30 to 35. You get one that's got a decent amount of kit in it, you're looking at 40, 50, which by that point you're in Ranger territory. And I just feel like a lot of the way that especially Ute buyers here are, they're all, you know, that kind of blokey-minded, whether they're male or female, but they've got that sort of bloke mindset where it's like it needs to be tough, it needs to have the capability, even if I'm never going to use half of that. So I just feel like, you know, it'll almost get like the hairdresser title, rightly or wrongly, where they'll just be like, oh, you bought the chick's truck because you got the one that doesn't have a 3.5-ton towing capacity, or it doesn't, you know, it can't go off-road the same way that a Ranger or Hilux can. So as much as it'd be cool to have diversity, and, you know, I worked at Ford for a little bit, and I find it frustrating that there's such a cool global portfolio that we just don't have access to in our market, that even in some cases New Zealand gets that we don't. That, I don't know, I just find, I think the Maverick's actually one of the ones that I don't think would do that well here, because people would just, you know, the Commodore and Falcon Ute are a different story. I think that was a style or a trend that was, you know, 10, 15 years ago now, that's far gone, and that's why they don't make them here anymore. I think this whole dual cab Ute thing is that people want, like the idea of a four-wheel drive, an SUV or whatever, and I just think that the reputation or the stigma that would surround a car like this, and this goes for Santa Cruz and any other car-based Ute that they offer in the States as well, is that all the guys and girls that drive Rangers, Hiluxes, Rams, or, you know, that kind of stuff, would just look at you and scoff at you for having a Maverick. So I don't know. I personally think that we can live without this one, because I don't think it would really find a place here given how competitive our market is already and how addicted to trends our Australian car buyers seem to be. As much as I want more choice, it'd be great to have something like that here, I guess. But I think, you know, a Bronco Sport, which is also escape based, also, you know, is more about the look than the actual capability, I think that would be a more logical thing to bring here than the Maverick. But that's my opinion. I'm not a Ute guy. I'm not in the minds of buyers as much as I'd like to think I am. So who knows? I might be wrong, but, you know, it is what it is.
Well, regardless, it's a bloody cool-looking pickup truck that we will never probably get to drive unless we go and rehearse next time we're at LAX.
Yeah. Get the violins out.
We'd love to hear your thoughts. If you'd like to get in touch with us, podcast at carexpert.com.au. And that wraps up this week's car news. World Car of the Year is in its 18th year, where automotive journalists from around the world are picked to be part of a jury to decide which car gets the acclaimed title, and a lot of other categories as well. It's an honour for any journalist to get this opportunity to be on the jury. And for the 2022 World Car of the Year, this one especially hits close to home, because Michael Harley is a Car Expert's Vice President of Product in the USA, and he has been chosen to be on the jury. Michael, thank you for your time and congratulations.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me on the show.
Can you give us some background on yourself and how you came to be part of the judging panel?
Let's give the 3-minute, what they call the elevator pitch is, obviously I was born and raised in the United States. I live in Los Angeles on the West Coast, which is not exactly really close to Australia. I guess I can live in Hawaii, would be a little bit closer, but, I actually went to school and studied pre-law. I was going to be an attorney and a lawyer. And, for the first 10 to 15 years of my career, I was in importing, exporting, something totally different. But I was discovered, air quotes, when somebody read a review that I wrote for like a car club, which is pretty cool. I wrote a story for a little a Porsche local car club out of Santa Barbara, believe it or not. And that was the person who had founded J.D. Power, which was a big awards company in the United States. They called me for an interview. I accepted the job, and I wrote some a bunch of car reviews. I think it was like 2006, 2007 models. And that snowballed rather quickly. So I started working for Autoblog, which is a big website, AutoWeb. I was an editor-in-chief, AutoByteShell, a whole bunch of auto stuff. And then finally, Kelley Blue Book. I was editor-in-chief for the past 4 years. And I started with the Car Expert. Let's see, it would have been late 2020 we started putting content up on the U.S. site. So
fantastic. So how does one become part of the jury for World Car of the Year?
There's a whole bunch of magic involved, and no bribery, unfortunately. And I don't know the secret sauce. I don't know. Maybe they like my hair, my eyes or something. But what I believe it is you are nominated by your peers, which you always hear, nominated by a team of esteemed peers. I believe these were fellow car journalists who were on the jury, and they nominated me, and I believe they voted in early May, and I was notified at the end of May, And I was super excited because I'd heard about the jury and I was, it had this mysterious, you know, aura to it. And now I'm part of it. So I had a crash course on trying to figure out exactly what happens now. And hopefully I can discuss it with you guys.
I that was going to be my next question, actually. what is your job involved as part of the jury member?
Let's see. Well, first of all, let's talk about what the World Car Awards is. And as you mentioned at the very beginning of the podcast, they're now in their 18th year. So they're founded about 2003, 2004, I believe. And they have a technical mission statement, which is to recognize, reward, and inspire automotive excellence, leadership, and innovation in the rapidly changing automotive industry on a global scale. So the idea is that they have jurors from all over the world, and they vote on cars in five different categories. One is the World Car of the Year. They've got the World Luxury Car, the World Performance Car, World Urban Car, and the World Car Design of the Year. And really quickly, if I want to go back and touch on those, like the current winners for 2021 would be like the Volkswagen ID.4 won World Car of the Year. The Luxury Car winner was the Mercedes-Benz S-Class. The performance car was Porsche 911 Turbo, which is the 992 model. The urban car was the Honda E, and the World Car Design of the Year was the Land Rover Defender. And it's important to note that, you know, cars are sold, you know, every different market of the world has different types of cars. So the eligibility requirements require that they are global brands. So you're not going to get a brand that's only sold in Florida or Pakistan or something like that. These have to be global brands, and they have to be sold in at least three different continents to be eligible. So obviously you're going to have some of the larger automakers, the ones that are going to take most of the awards, you know, the Mercedes or the Fords or the Audis and the Volkswagens that sell a lot of cars, and they're exposed to the most jurors.
So it's one thing to review a car in isolation or to do a comparison test with just yourself and a couple of colleagues, but the most useful way to really get your head around products and compare them to others is to kind of have a chat with other experts in the field. At least that's what I find. So to what degree, Michael, do you get to discuss your thoughts and findings with other jurors before the awards are actually decided? Because it is such a global exercise in a time where travel is so restricted.
Actually, an excellent question. So what they have done in the past, and I believe they'll be able to do this fall, is as far as the U.S. jurors are concerned, we try to meet and we try to tell all the automakers to bring all the cars to the LA Auto Show, which happens in November in Los Angeles. And the idea is to bring as many cars as possible and as many jurors as possible to that one location. I believe there are 22 jurors in the United States. And we take them up a road called the Angeles Crest Highway, which climbs out of Pasadena and goes up about 6,000 or 7,000 feet, incredibly windy. And it's 10 to 20 miles all the way to the top. And we go up and down all day long and have lunches and sit around and talk over dinner. And, you know, that's probably the best way we evaluate the vehicles in a team. We also get the vehicles individually. You know, if there's a car we just can't get at that event, we'll borrow the car for a week. Now, as far as talking to other journalists on a global scale, I don't expect to talk to anyone in Brazil or Argentina or anything like that. But we do vote and nominate finalists, and then we get to re-vote again.
Michael, the World Car of the Year obviously is a global award. There's so many different manufacturers that you're judging and their products. And you've sort of already touched on how it's a very holistic holistic way of assessing vehicles. How many different criterias or categories of, you know, of the vehicle that you do you have to assess and judge? And, you know, do you do individual scores for like five categories within a subcategory, which kind of counts toward an overall score? Or is there a certain way of scoring that you guys use for this award?
James, that's a tough one, because what happens is I am given a ballot and I haven't seen the secret ballot yet. It's out of the envelope, but I haven't been handed a ballot for 2022. And it does have a bunch of scoring criteria. And it has to do with design, ergonomics, fuel efficiency, comfort, handling, chassis dynamics, everything like that. So it's very subjective. It's not a 0 to 60, what's the curb weight or anything like that. It's, you know, it's just We all drive them. And, you know, you guys review cars. You know, what I always tell people is when people ask me, how hard is it to review a car? I say, well, hang on a second. How many pizzas have you had in your entire life? And they go, oh my gosh, I've eaten 500 different pizzas. And I said, well, tell you what, if I give you a slice of pizza, in the first two or three bites, you can tell me whether it's a good pizza or not. And they go, of course I can. I said, well, that's what happens. We drive so many different cars every year that honestly, within a block or two, all of us can sit there and say, you know what, I'm going to go park this one. I'm going to go drive something else. And it's just because, you know, the automotive expert in us, you know, of course, some of us have skills. We can write, we can talk, we can be on video, but it's the fact we're exposed to so many different vehicles. And we just, it's a gut feeling. It's just, you know, it's like shoes. You put on a pair of shoes and you go, okay, this works, this doesn't work. But it's, you know, I always use the pizza analogy because everyone's eating a lot of pizza and everyone thinks they're an expert on pizza. You take one bite of a pizza and that one bite tells you whether it's a good pizza or not. So
that's fantastic. Look, Michael, I don't know whether you'll be able to answer this question, but in your opinion, what car do you think deserves to win the 2022 World Car of the Year?
Oh my gosh. You know, we live in such an interesting time as far as the industry goes. You know, had this been back in the 70s when all vehicles were combustion, you know, 60s, all vehicles were combustion, body on frame, rear wheel drive, four speed automatics or four speed manual gearboxes, carburetors, you know, power steering, maybe power brakes. And they were just so alike. But today we have rear wheel drive, we have all wheel drive, we have four wheel drive, we have CVTs, we have dual clutch, we have single clutch on. I mean, so much diversity. And then I haven't even touched the electric cars, the hydrogen cars, the plug-in hybrids. You know, that's such a challenging question. I believe it's going to be you know, just in this year alone, we have so many new electric vehicles hitting the market, at least in the States. I believe it's going to be someone that has a hybrid, that has a lot of technology, because consumers right now are demanding so much technology. The infotainment systems, they want to be able to be on their phone and walk right into their vehicle and have a seamless transaction and still be on the call. And all of a sudden, they've got their Spotify and they've got their music and they've got their Waze. So they've got their mapping. They get out of the car and they still want to be on that same call. And they don't want to have to sit there and say, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? You know, so they want transportation. They want comfort. They want luxury. They want technology. They want it all. And so the automaker is a challenge to deliver that. So I think the car that's going to win that is going to be able to deliver all that. It's not going to be a, you know, one trick pony, they call. I just think it's so fascinating because I always go back and laugh. You know, I'm in my early 50s and I only became an automotive journalist in my late 40s. So the good news for all your listeners out there that are thinking, man, you know, I really want to do what these guys do is there's still plenty of time to do it. And now is about as good as it gets because you don't have to be a gearhead. You can be someone who's really obsessed with the technology. You can be someone who's obsessed with the environmental. You can be of someone who likes to wrench in their car, likes to race in their car, just likes to look at the car aesthetically. And so the most fascinating thing about our jobs is the you know, arena is so diverse. And that's what I'm always telling people because people are always asking us, hey, how do we get your job? And I said, just write about something interesting. So,
was it a hard decision to make to shift from law after studying it and going into automotive journalism?
No, easy job. because I don't want to say a hit on the pay, but it was, you know, I'm a car guy. I love cars. I love racing cars. I love wrenching on cars. I can't get out of a car without turning around and looking at it, whether it's the base Toyota or the top of the line Ferrari. I find something interesting in just about everything. And, you know, to be able to combine my job with my passion, everyone always says that's the dream, but I've been able to do it, and I couldn't be more pleased.
You won't ever work a day in your life now, Michael, it sounds like it.
Exactly.
We wish you all the very best of luck with World Car of the Year, and once again, congratulations. It really has been a joy talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. It's great seeing you guys.
Hello, Tony Crawford.
Hello, Mandy. How are you?
You've recently driven the updated Kia Cerato.
I did, Mandy. As I said to you a moment ago, it's the I didn't think I'd ever get back into a Kia Cerato. I can't remember the last time I drove a Kia Cerato. But this one, I didn't drive the sedan, although I did see the sedan. I only drove the GT Hatch, which is the top of the line. Still a fairly inexpensive car at $36,990 drive away. And that is with a 7-year factory warranty, 7-year roadside assist, and 7-year fixed price servicing. Not bad, is it? Great package. And they've updated it. It's only a midlife facelift. So this thing came out in 2018. So they've upped the ante with headlights. It's a cleaner look. Most important thing, though, besides the looks, is it carries and wears the new Kia a corporate badge, if you like. And let me tell you that you may not think there's much in a badge, but this badge is so nice that it actually makes the Cerato look even better than what the updated facelift nip and tuck is. So I'm a huge fan of the way they've ditched the badge per se, and they've just sort of in script, a modern contemporary script, just the word Kia, and it looks fabulous on the front and the back. And I believe that that step alone is enough to elevate this brand in the eyes of people's perception. And I think that's going to be very important going forward for Kia, as they get prepared to launch their first EV they're actually going to start building it this year, called the EV6, which is going to go head-to-head with the Ioniq 5 from Hyundai, their sister company. And I'm told secret people within Kia that the EV6 will also have a performance version that will be likely 0-100 in under 3.5 seconds. This is quite extraordinary to me.
So, Croft, I think we've all got experience with the pre-facelift Cerato GT, but it's really good that we've had a chance to revisit it. 150-kilowatt turbo engine, dual-clutch transmission, features mm-hmm. like LED headlights, wireless charger, JBL premium sound system, paddle shifters, ventilated front seats, a full sunroof, that massive warranty that you talked about, for $37,000 on the road. This thing's an absolute steal. But my question is, the price they're asking for it is about the same as a real entry-level premium European small car, maybe even a little cheaper. But it comes loaded to the gills with stuff. It's obviously got a hell of a lot more performance, the Australian suspension tune, the latest in infotainment. Does it make a case for itself not just as a mainstream hatch, but as a competitor for more premium products as well, in a way that it can actually lift up the Kia brand?
Moko, I'd like to say that, and you're right. You've listed a whole bunch of features which it has, and the GT, I'll come back to handling and performance in a minute, but where it doesn't live up to the Euros is in the cabin, just the aesthetics within the cabin. All those features are nice, but to be honest, I wouldn't even call it semi-premium.
Why would you set up?
It's just that there's a – even though there was metal accents around the – around the cabin, but particularly around the air conditioning vents, which are quite large, and they look – it was brushed metal and it looks nice, but there's just something about it that it doesn't live up to the Euro, and I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger on it specifically. The seats are great. As you said, the stereo's great. The sunroof there for the first time with Cerato, and it's a big sunroof. But I don't know. Look, maybe there's just too much grey. It's not that there was any lack of soft touch points, because there was plenty of those, more than Volkswagen, you might say. But there's something about getting into a Golf or getting into a Tiguan they still haven't got there, my mind. I think Hyundai does a slightly better job with the interior. It always seems to look just a little cut above another 10% in terms of the overall look and feel. And I think Kia's got a little way to go yet. But, you know, you can't beat that price, as Moko said. And you can talk about Euro derivatives, but the end of the day is Most people don't want to own a Euro car after the warranty expires. And you can ask Euro buyers that, and they all have a sad story usually. After the warranty expires. And of course, with 7 years, 7 years roadside assistance, 7 years fixed price, it's an almost an unbeatable no-brainer, isn't it? Even to purchase one of those over the Hyundai equivalent, which of course only have 5 years. How can you argue with that? I mean, to sell a five-year-old car to someone with a two-year factory warranty remaining, and it is transferable, let's be clear about that. That's almost, for me, you can't not buy the Kia as opposed to a Hyundai. That's what I would say. I spoke to Graham Gumbolt, who does all the local tuning for Kia, and he was very interesting. I said, I got in this car after driving quite spiritedly across B roads in southern New South Wales, southern Highlands, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, what the F? Like, this car is, like, as someone didn't tell me about this car. This car is seriously good. I can't call it a hot hatch because it only has 150 kilowatts and 265 newton meters, but it does put the power down exceedingly well, and it only weighs 1,300 plus kilos. So, you know, we're talking about not a lot of weight, but the way this car handled and the steering ratio, the suspension tune, got me thinking, and I sort of got a text when I'd finished, just by the chance, from Roland, who said, "What did you think of it?" And I said, you know, I just kind of said, it's like, holy shit, dude. I mean, this car is way better than what people are thinking. And I spoke to Graham. I said, mate, what is it about? What have you done to this? It feels like an N car. And he said, well, funny you say that, because the tuning that we got from the factory for this car was for the virtually mirrored the Proceed GT in Europe. So this is why this car feels very well hooked up. They've done the suspension tuning locally to do the spring rates and the sway bars, and they've also limited the rebound, which is very important, because with more excessive rebound, it means wheels are leaving the ground, tires are leaving the ground. So if you get the rebound right, at the way Graham has done with the Cerato GT, you get a very, very well composed car, and you can go into corners at warp speed as far as this car goes, change direction very well, and it feels very confident, inspiring. And I think people are going to get a real surprise with this Cerato GT in particular. We didn't sample any other variant, unfortunately, so I only got to talk about this one. But I think go for a test drive if you're thinking you don't want to spend a fortune. You want all that kit, and you also want a car that can mix it up with some proper with some proper hot hatches, I dare say. You might get left on the straight, but in the corners, you're not going to be far behind a full-strength Hyundai i30N. Again, that's incredibly surprising. And when I heard the words and what Graham Gumbold had done with the suspension, it all made sense to me. James.
So, Croft, you sort of touched on, you know, the updated look. There's a few more features, and obviously there's the extensive local tuning program that Kia does in Australia for most of its cars, not all of them, but most of them, including the Cerato. So in your chats with the engineers and some of the product planners, did they actually say if they've done anything different to the last one? Because what you've described is very much the characteristic of the pre-facelift. And in all the press materials, they haven't really gone on to say whether they've actually changed anything compared to the pre-facelift car in terms of suspension tune, throttle calibration, all that kind of stuff. Did you notice if there was anything like in that vein with this new car, or is it very much sticking to a well-received formula already?
I can't really answer that, mate, because I didn't drive the previous iteration, unfortunately. Probably when you get behind the wheel in Melbourne, you'll be more for that. And when Paul does a video, perhaps on the car, you could probably answer that. But no, I did. I got the impression that they had fiddled with the tuning on this car. But you might be right. Not having driven it, I didn't really ask that question because, again, I hadn't driven the car before. It was all new to me. Serato GT. I was just blown away. I suspect it would have. I suspect he's done. They've done more to this car because I just can't believe you can get a car for that money that can hustle into rough cross country B roads. Rough country B roads with the amount of adhesion and the grip and the feel through the steering wheel that you can get for 36,990 drive away. I mean, it blows my mind.
Need to get Echo on it around the racetrack.
Well, I guarantee you actually could because there is zero body roll when you go into a corner at speed, and it puts the power down beautifully. There's a lot of mid-range torque. I think peak torque goes up to 4,500 from 1,500 RPM, so you've got plenty of grunt under the bonnet. A couple of times, the only negative thing I put in the review was the 7-speed dual clutch when I was coming into a couple of corners in manual mode, that is flicking the shifter to the left, I believe, or right, I've forgotten. It wouldn't shift down when I wanted it to shift down. Now, that may not be a mistake of the gearbox. It's usually a rev protection software that stops you doing that. But, you know, I wanted to get that down another gear into third. But I will say the middle gears are stacked quite short, so there could be a reason for that. But that was probably my only negative, and the fact that, you know, I still want to see a bit more pizzazz in Kia cabins. And I think the Sorento gets it right. I think the Carnival gets it right. But I think Serato could even do with a bit more pizzazz. I don't know about you, J-Wo, what you feel about Serato interiors, but...
I'd probably agree with you. What you were saying before, how it's probably not quite European level of interior fit and finish and ambience, but from what you've described and from what I remember of the pre-facelift car, the driving experience is certainly up there. So I'm assuming that the interior fit, like the interior materials probably haven't changed that much, but that new infotainment screen is a very good screen. Yeah, it's a shame they didn't bring in the digital instrument cluster that you can get in Korea, because that would really elevate it as well.
Another negative that I put down, when you can get it in Skoda, you can get it in Volkswagen, you get it in Renault, even the Renault Captur has a fully digital instrument display. And I did question them on that, and I think they just can't get it. Otherwise, Australia would definitely option that, you know.
Well, hopefully it becomes available soon.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. The review is live now at carexpert.com.au. Tony Crawford, thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
That's a wrap for this week's podcast. Have we still got plenty of events and launches happening next week, Moko?
We do. There are still plenty of things happening, some virtual, some real life. We didn't get to talk about this today, but we will next week, of course. The Mark 8 Volkswagen Golf launch has just gone on. Car launches don't get much bigger than a new Golf, so keep your ears out for that. And then next week we've got a launch of the new Golf GTI. So they've kind of staggered and split the launch procedure for that. There is a preview of a new Audi model that I can't really give much more away on, but I can say that. We've got an event, James, that you're doing for the EQA Mercedes-Benz electric crossover SUV. We're also going to find out more about the Cupra brand, the Spanish spin-off of Seat. That's quite an alliterative sentence, isn't it? We've also got a GWM immersion event that I'll be going to. GWM is the reborn Great Wall Motor, telling us about all the exciting stuff that they're working on behind the scenes as well. So some really interesting launch events is coming up over the next week or two. And, you know, rain, hail or shine, there's always going to be new cars to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And always new cars coming through the garage. What's up next week, J-Wo?
We've actually got quite a lot. So I'll be driving the new Mercedes-Benz E350 sedan, which I probably won't be able to talk about to the end of June because that's a new car under drive impression embargo. And then we've got a pair of Hyundai SUVs. So we've got the new Hyundai Tucson base model as well as the Hyundai Santa Fe V6. And then following the Queen's birthday weekend, we've got the Volkswagen Touareg Wolfsburg edition, which is that really cool sort of like black edition thing that basically has every option box ticked and it looks really boss. We've got the brand new Toyota Kluger GX Hybrid. We've got the GWM Havel Jolion, which is a vehicle that seems to be getting a lot of interest lately because we ran that pricing story that, you know, it's very sharply priced and it looks kind of cool. So I think people are really interested to hear what that's all about. We'll be running a comparison between the Mazda MX-30 and the Toyota CHR hybrid. So mild hybrid versus parallel hybrid or series hybrid, however you label the Toyota ones. That'll be an interesting one. We've also got the hybrid version of the Kia Niro Sport. So that's a new car for Kia that's quite important. In Sydney, we've got the Kia Niro plug-in hybrid, then swapping into a Sportage diesel, but the current one. So we've talked about the all-new one in the news section, and so we're sort of doing a run-out review of the current generation before it gets killed off. And then Tony will be driving the all-new Golf GTI, the 8th generation one, as part of the event that Mike just talked about, but he'll be taking that for a week and doing a review on that. I actually saw one of those in Melbourne recently before we went into lockdown, and it was at nighttime, and they have this weird light bar at the front now. So normally light bars are at the back, but this, they've got it at the front. I don't know how I feel about it. Because
it's like
I was looking,
GTI light, like a red?
No, literally the top outline of the grill, or the lack of grill that's now between the headlights, has a full width light bar across the front connecting the headlights. So it's got this weird monobrow effect. And from a distance, it looked really strange. I was like, what the hell has got this full width light bar across the front? Because you know how some people do those things for like vans and four-wheel drives? And I was just like, this is such a weird-looking car. What is it? And then I got close and I was like, oh, that's the new Golf. And I was like, I was sort of warming to the design a little bit. If that's what you look like at night, I don't know if I like that.
I'm interested to see that now.
Yeah, me too. I'll have to get a proper up-close look because it looked very odd, and it looked like the middle light strip wasn't the same brightness as everything else. So I was just all like mind blown. But, yeah, we'll have to wait and see. We'll see what Croft thinks about it. He'll probably spend 5 minutes talking about the LED filaments or something and saying why it's the best thing ever.
I was going to say we probably have a whole separate podcast on him talking about it.
I don't reckon you're too far off, old mate Crawford, in the waffling steak BTW wongy.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see, I guess.
It has been fun. Thank you so much, James Wong and Mike Costello.
It's always
Thanks,
awesome.
Mandy.
Well, Mandy, thank you.